ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello, and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Mr. Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me is my co-host, Mr. Chad Riley.
Hi, howdy, how you doing?
How's it going today, my friend?
So well.
I am so excited for today's show. I'm just
you
super
have so
amped.
Much energy, I have
do.
To say.
We had dinner, and I was like, I was full, but then I still have all this energy, and just I'm just so excited to be here. So
wow.
We got an exciting show in store for you guys today. We got a great review of an awesome film, and you know
usually
what?
We starve him before the podcast, so now we'll have to reverse our plan.
Yeah, now I'm just going to have to make sure I eat like normal people before I get here to the studio.
That is actually true. Usually I wolf something down before we record, and you wait until afterward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We might actually have stumbled upon something today.
Gold, my friend, gold. The Filmlosophers is presented by Mingle Media TV and recorded live each and every week at VGB Studios here in sunny Sacramento, California. Filmlosophers fans, take note. You can subscribe to the Filmlosophers podcast on your favorite platforms and download previous episodes from Google Play, Stitcher, Audio Boom, Player FM, iTunes, or Libsyn. Yeah. You can also Filmlosophize us with us on social media.
I was going to say, you were your own hype man for a second, and then it kind of just derailed.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's me. I'm the balloon that only goes so high. Like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. There you can share your thoughts about recent movie news and let us know what you think about our latest episodes. Also, you can check us out on our website at vgbstudios.com where you can find our podcast along with some other great podcasts such as the Video Game Bang Crew and Me, Mike, Self, and I, which is with comedian Mike Betancourt. So shout out to Mike Betancourt if you're hearing. Love you, brother. But like I said, we got a great show in store. This film, we've actually had a lot of good time to discuss and to really dig into the research and really find the good nuggets in it. And I think we got an awesome amount of content to really give to you guys today. So
yeah,
I'm
it's
excited.
Good. We got a nice advanced preview screening. It still isn't out in theaters for a couple weeks. So
yeah.
You've got some advance notice on this film.
Tis true. But before we get to that, of course, we always hit movie news. And at the top of our list, we got Benicio del Toro is added to the cast for an upcoming Predator reboot. So,
say what?
So, Deadline is reporting that Benicio del Toro is in early talks to star.
Wait,
in
say it again.
Benicio del Toro.
I knew you had it in
que
you.
Que hora es? Is in early talks to star in Predator, the reboot of the franchise in the works at 20th Century Fox. Shane Black is actually aboard to direct, and a little known fact about Black is that actually he co-starred in the original 1987 film alongside Arnold Schwarzenegger. He played one of the members of his team, and he actually, sadly, he does die in the film. But if you remember, he's the skinny guy with the glasses who's always trying to make a joke. In the first Predator film, he's like always trying to make like a raunchy joke and make everybody laugh, and
that's why he's the first to go,
and that's why he dies. There you go. That's Filmlosopher Tip 101. Don't be a jerk.
Keep
in a movie.
Keep it clean, y'all.
You're gonna die. Just plain and simple. he played a member of Arnold's team. Black's Monster Squad co-writer Fred Decker is scripting the new Predator. I was a huge fan of Monster Squad. I still am. I have the actual special edition Blu-ray at home somewhere. So to know that this duo is actually going to be teaming back up, I'm actually excited about what could possibly happen with this film. Like we were talking just before we got on the air, the Predator film had actually had a previous reboot before this one under the name Predators, multiple.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Plural. And that one had
Adrian Brody
as the main tough guy.
Eh.
And you know what? I have to say the film, the premise of the film was good. The idea of it, the fact that all these people, so the premise of that film was that all these people get kidnapped or so to speak abducted from where they're at, where they're from, and they are released in this reserve. And the predators are the ones who come to the reserve, much like some kind of like extraterrestrial country club or something, and they come to the reserve and they hunt them down.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they get the I guess the warriorist of the warriors from Earth. Like they had somebody from the Yakuza, they had somebody from the Mexican cartel, an assassin from the Mexican cartel. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. They had mercenaries, they had police officers, they had Russian people. They had all these different types of individuals who are the most bad A's of the bad A's.
Yeah, the deadliest of the deadly humans.
And so the bad part about that film was that Adrian Brody just isn't one of those types of guys.
No, he really isn't.
The entire film, he's talking like, guys, we got to go this way, and we got to go over here and hide out, and this and that. And you look at Adrian Brody, and you're like, you should be wearing glasses and a pocket protector.
Hey, don't judge a book by its cover.
I saw the movie!
I didn't, because I did judge the book by its cover.
And I'm still judging the book by its cover. Del Toro is also aboard Soldado, which is the second installment of the drug war thriller that began with 2015's Sicario. What do you think about Del Toro being added to a film that has such infamy in history of action films?
I'm interested to see what kind of a role they would have him play,
mm-hmm.
because he was phenomenal. He's usually phenomenal. Yeah. I'll step back. He's usually phenomenal in what he does.
It's true.
I would totally believe him as a deadly, you know, assassin dude. Sicario, he was particularly effective because...
Yeah.
Most of the beginning, two-thirds of the film, you don't actually know
who he is or what his
purpose
is.
How intense he can be. You know that he has connections. You don't know exactly what they are.
Yeah.
And you don't know how ruthless. And, I mean, once he hops into action in that last third of the movie,
mm-hmm.
It is riveting. You're stuck watching him. But I'd be interested to see if he's, like... Is he the main character, or is he just in the movie? Like, is he a cameo-ish appearance?
One of the things about Benicio Del Toro that I've always recognized is that he's more of a quiet strength individual. Like we talked about with Sicario, in the first two-thirds of the film, you recognized his presence more than his action. You recognized the onstage appearance of him, and that's what you recognize as the authority over his, like, ability to do action ahead of time. And... Like I said, in Sicario, he just
more brains than brawn.
Exactly, because that's how he pretty much was able to function in the first two-thirds of Sicario. And mind you, yes, we keep referencing Sicario because it is an awesome movie.
It really is.
So great.
I mean, it's a rough movie to sit through, but it is a really good movie.
I don't know. With something so iconic as Predator, I don't know if... Because Arnold Schwarzenegger was very like, come on, do it! Come right here, do it! Kill me!
Is that your Arnold Schwarzenegger impression?
Get to the chopper! All that kind of stuff. He was more very, like, expressive. He was more, like, just out there, out loudish. He was very much the visual actor, so to speak.
Oh, for sure, yeah. Very, very on the nose. Not a lot of subtlety there.
Now, I was thinking about it while you were talking. You know what Benicio Del Toro could play? If you guys remember the actual original Predator film, the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you guys remember the tracker? The Native American tracker?
I don't, but just you saying that says Benicio Del Toro.
It does. Like, yeah. the guy is like, something in the woods, it's finding us, it's looking for us. And
the guy that's figured it all out ahead of time.
Oh, yeah, which just happens to be the Native American, you know, who, you know, your typical Native American tracker who's like,
I am one with the wind. Yes.
Kind of deal. That's
you are all, I mean, you are voices, and man, we got to feed this guy more often.
So, you know what, we will keep you up to date with the information that comes through here and let you know what ends up transgressing because of that casting. But moving forward, Peter Berg wants Jonah Hill to opposite Dwayne Johnson in The Rundown 2. So Peter Berg and Dwayne Johnson collaborated for the first time in the action comedy The Rundown in 2003, which is a great film.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that film.
The Rock was a bounty hunter tasked with tracking down his boss's troublemaking son, Sean William Scott, and hauling him out of the jungles of Brazil. It was a wild ride and fun, and a fun one for that, with supporting roles that turned out to be Christopher Walken and Rosario Dawson. It was a great experience. It was a really fun movie, really animated. It's one of those really big first experiences you have with Dwayne Johnson as an actor.
Right, yeah. It was one of his breakout, main A-list star kind of roles.
Because, mind you, you had His appearance in The Mummy 2, and then you had his appearance in that corny film, The Scorpion King, which both were just garbage. And then you see him step out into a more leading role, which he was. He was the primary character throughout the entire film from beginning to end. It's a great one of mine.
Well, and it's got some comedy in it. Like, it really... That you take somebody like The Rock, I mean, very similar to like an Arnold Schwarzenegger type, and you're like, dude, this guy is just huge. Mm-hmm. Like, he's got action movie star, maybe not hero, maybe bad
guy,
whatever.
Go to
like,
Brazil.
He's got all this written all over him, and you don't like, I from his time in, you know, with as a wrestler, you knew that he had a personality because he would express it all the time. But
the people's champ.
Could he have that personality as an actor? Embodying a character you didn't really know, this film kind of gave you every indication that he could.
Yeah. Well, with that film, Peter Berg, the director of that film, was asked about the possibility of a sequel to that one. And while at the Toronto International Film Festival, Collider got a chance to check in with him and ask him, hey, what's the deal? What's the possibility of a sequel for that one? And he said, and I quote, you know, I wanted to do it with Kevin Hart and Dwayne Johnson. If I could get Jonah Hill, I'd do it tomorrow. If I could get Dwayne and Jonah Hill, I'd do it tomorrow. So it sounds like he's kind of sold on this mentality of, you know, you have Dwayne Johnson, who's this large, towering, you know, inferno of a man who's just raging of masculinity. And then you have somebody who's like, you know, like me, smaller in comparison to Dwayne Johnson, someone who's like me, who's like smaller and a little bit more on the you know.
So basically, you're saying if Jonah Hill's not available, you'll take the role.
I am definitely Peter Berg. If you're listening to this, I am definitely on the docket for this one. You can pay
to
me
to be Jonah Hill's stunt double.
To be no
Eddie Villanueva, folks.
Not
stunt
even
double.
I will take his role. I will do it. I will do it. You know,
I don't know. See, I don't know how I feel about this. The Rock, love it. The Peter Berg, love his stuff. Even things like Battleship that don't do well. I mean, I've truly followed him since Friday Night Lights.
Yes.
Both the film and the TV show were phenomenal, and he did a great job telling a character-driven story in both cases. And I followed him. You know, he has Deepwater Horizon coming out.
Yes.
This fall, he was at Toronto International Film Festival debuting the film, and
that's true.
So that looks exciting, and but yeah, Jonah Hill, he's hit or miss for me because he oftentimes kind of plays different characters with the same tone or the same beats, and I'm just I don't know.
It's
I don't
sad
know.
Because of the fact that nowadays most recent actors are kind of stuck in they're not playing to the role. They're allowing the role to play to them. They're just pretty much putting themselves in the situation. So you got directors who are like, okay, well, I'm going to make this role, and I'm going to make it pretty much to the same persona as so-and-so or as such-and-such. And I think Jonah Hill is just one of those ones where I personally don't care for his humor. I don't really like it. He's done a lot of collaborations with like Seth Rogen and that whole team, you know, from This
Is
the End. Yep. He was just recently in Sausage Party.
I saw him recently in Hail Caesar, which was a better turn for him because number one, small doses. He was in it like maybe three scenes.
I haven't
maybe
seen that
two.
One yet.
And also he played against type, which is helpful when you get somebody who's kind of like, not only do I recognize your face, but I recognize your performance style. Then, like, if I don't want to see that style for an entire feature-length film, I'm not going to probably see the film. But if I get it in small doses, and if you're playing really, truly against type, then suddenly he was actually really interesting.
And that's another thing, too, because I haven't seen it personally, but we know of people
who
have
seen
it. Well,
he ended up with Scarlett Johansson's character in the film.
In?
Hail Caesar.
Oh, Hail Caesar.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there you go. To all the rotund individuals out there, there's hope. No, but even to his credit, I haven't seen it, like I said, but I did hear good things about it with Moneyball. Apparently that was also another one where it was against his normal type of
standout.
Standout performances. So, but then on the other end of the spectrum, though, do we really want another Dwayne Johnson / Kevin Hart mashup? I mean, one was kind of enough.
Well, and they're trying to turn that one into a franchise, so I mean, you'll probably get more than one anyway. So having Kevin Hart be the I don't even know what to call him. The other guy in this story, I don't know that that would be great. The whole, that original film, the Rundown,
mm-hmm.
It works as a standalone movie.
Ta-ka, ta-ka.
I don't know that you need to have a sequel. And it's been so long that why would you try now?
Yeah, because by then you already have Sean William Scott's son? Who
the earliest this would come out would be 2018, which would be 15 years after the first one. It's a long time for a sequel.
Not to mention if you're going to put The Rock back into a position where he has to go hunt people down, it just means he never made that restaurant, and I feel sad for him. I'd feel bad.
Yeah.
Be like, there you go.
There you go.
Anyway, we're also moving on with Saturday Night Live. We actually hear of a historic thing that has happened this week.
They fired everybody.
They fired everybody. But they hired someone in particular. They've hired three new faces, four, I think, actually. But one of them in particular is probably the one to be most celebrated. They hired their first Latina comedian ever in the history of SNL.
That's awesome.
After unceremoniously dropping comedians Jay Farrow, Taron Killam, and John Rudnitsky from their lineup, NBC's Saturday Night Live has now added three young comics into the rotation for their upcoming 42nd season. While the trio of newcomers is to the small screen improv showcase clearly brings fresh talent to the stage, there has already been a lot of focus on one person in particular, Melissa Villaseñor, the series' first Latina.
Oh, I know you did
Latina.
Not just do that.
Villaseñor.
Thank you.
Melissa Villaseñor.
Thank you.
The series' first Latina performer. I don't know if you remember, I was actually a really big fan of America's Got Talent when she was on it. And I remember her audition. And at first I was like, she's funny. She did a really great Kathy Griffin. She did a really great...
Yeah, she does impersonations.
She does. And she made it to a good amount. I don't think she won, but she did make it pretty far into the thing. I do remember her getting cut. But all that hard work has persevered, and, you know, she's made it on to SNL, which is a great thing. It seems that the emphasis with the new cast additions this year is on improv and sketch comedy skills and talents that work best in the group dynamic rather than in solo moments, like during SNL's Weekend Update, for example.
Which is so interesting, because the guys that they got rid of... Well, two of the guys they got rid of, Jay Farrow and Taron Killam, have been on there for years, and they were constantly in group sketches. So it's interesting, you know, to see maybe they just didn't have good improv skills and they had to always stick to a script.
Possibility.
But, I mean, they really weren't. They would also do the standalone, like the digital segments or whatever, where it's I'm pretending to be an actor auditioning for a movie or whatever. Like, I mean, Jay Farrow would do Eddie Murphy all the time. But, I mean, he also was... Well, no, maybe now that I'm thinking about it, Taron Killam was in scenes with other people. I don't know about the other two as much.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that the other guy, the Rudnitsky, he was only on for a couple years anyway.
And that's the thing. When it comes to SNL, I'm... As sad as it is to say, I'm not that big of a fan. I don't really watch it, period. But... I do know that Chad, you actually watched it and continue to watch it when you can, but you're more of a
I'm not like a up late anymore like those kids down the way. But
was that New Yorker or was that old?
I don't know what that was. It was both
great.
The old New Yorker. I mean I tend to I'll watch recaps of specific scenes or sketches that get good, you know, airplay in the week following an episode. But I used to watch it quite a bit. You know, live when it would come on Saturday night. But yeah, not as much anymore. More the specific sketches.
What do you think it's going to do to NBC's ratings, especially for this show, having somebody like, first off, having this type of momentous event happen where you have the first ever Latina come onto the scene and come into the cast? Do you think it's going to just kind of be like the flavor of the month, just be up there, the ratings for just a little bit, and then die down? Or do you think this could be like a starting trend?
With Saturday Night Live, it all comes down to the talent of the performers. I mean, there's a certain appeal to whoever the guest host of the week is, guest musical act. I mean, they'll draw people in sometimes if they're really popular. But if your talent pool on that show is just not that funny or doesn't compare very well to previous casts, then viewership drops off like crazy. So it kind of depends. I mean, you have to kind of see them in action, not only individually, but in the crew, in the group, as members of the cast, to see if it's gonna work. Because they did do the big push, what, 2 years ago now with Rudnitsky, I think, was one of them. But they brought in younger, like the millennial comedians. And
isn't that when the chick from Ghostbusters, the one with the glasses, wasn't that when she came on as well?
She was a little bit, Kate McKinnon was a little bit before that. But I mean, she did come on as one of those featured performers that then became a cast member. They have different gradations for who, you know, what level you are on the show. But yeah, but it, the interesting thing to me though is this is an election year. SNL really shines around political commentary, comedy, and satire, and so it'll be interesting to see like who do they have as their go-to Donald Trump, who do they have as their go-to Hillary Clinton, who do they have as their go-to, you know, correspondent, like Matt Lauer, whenever they make fun of how he got, you know, belittled for some of his, you know, mediation a couple weeks ago. And so it'll be interesting to see, because you know, I don't know. I don't know what direction they're going to go in, but it'll be pretty apparent relatively quickly whether or not they're worth watching more than once.
Tis true. And, of course, we applaud Melissa Villaseñor as far as being that first Latina. But
hats off to her.
Hats off. I mean, it's really incredible. It's momentous. But that segues us into our special presentation today of our review. Ladies and gentlemen, we are reviewing Disney's live-action film, Queen of Katwe. Now, just a quick side note, we've kind of been going back and forth for a good amount of time trying to really figure out how to really pronounce Katwe.
We're just not going to pull it off.
So, we're saying right now, please cut us some slack as we say some of these names, because we really are not trying to butcher anybody, but we know we're going to butcher their names. So, you know what? Hey, here's to hoping, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know what? We both grew up speaking English as our native language, and sometimes the vowel sounds and it just doesn't translate right. So forgive us.
But Queen of Katwe, the film about a young girl from Uganda who trains to become a world chess champion, directed by accomplished film director, writer, producer, all around just awesome woman, Mira Nair. The film stars newcomer Madina Nalwanga, Lupita Nyong'o, David Oyelowo. Oyelowo, and many others.
Hey, hats off to you. I mean, you know, hats off to you.
Hey, you know, I'm trying. The film is based off of a book called The Queen of Katwe, a story of life, chess, and one extraordinary girl's dream of becoming a grandmaster. That's a lot. That's
a big title,
That title must have taken up like half the book. There was no room for the picture of the girl. It was just like all title, and she was like,
I mean, it tells you exactly what it's about. Unlike the title of the film, because I mean, you go to the film, and if you haven't read anything before seeing the film, you're like, "What is this movie about?" Before you have a little bit of an indication from the movie poster, because there's like a chess piece, and it's like a shot of the girl's hair, and it's got different elements from the story, kind of all around her head, and then one of them is a chess piece. So you kind of get it there, but you don't
aside
exactly
that,
know
yeah.
what it's about.
Yeah, and honestly, for the longest, I was unsure. I'll just be honest with you. I was a little unsure as far as what the movie was fully about. It wasn't until before going into the press screening that I actually looked it up. I'm like, okay, it's kind of like an African version of Searching for Bobby Fischer kind of deal. You know, you have this young person who's, you know, looking for or wanting to become this grandmaster in chess and so forth. And
well,
so,
one of the other things that's really cool about this film is the time period that it's set in. I mean, you go into it and it's set in Uganda, and there's a girl who's, you know, trying to learn chess and become a grandmaster over time. But going into the film, I didn't know how like contemporary the story is. It's actually like just a few years ago. That the events of this book took place.
Oh, most definitely. I mean,
or this movie, well, book/movie.
The book was written by Tim Crothers, who is actually a writer for ESPN. So, I don't know if you remember seeing this in the credits of the film, but it did say that the film was produced by Disney Studios and ESPN Studios. So it's an ESPN.
Well, on the screening that we went to actually did have a essentially ESPN commercial right before the film, and it was we were sitting there like, wait, why?
Yeah. It's true. We were utterly confused.
We did not do our homework before the movie, but we did do our homework after.
Yes. The film premiered at the 2016 Toronto International Film Festival, receiving much praise for its diversity and casting choices. The film does a really great job at utilizing the young people and the individuals that they did. The film depicts the life of Fiona Mutasi, a Ugandan chess prodigy from Katwe, who tries to overcome life's adversities and becomes a world candidate master after her performance at the World Chess Olympiads. The film obviously is a biopic. It's not a fictitious story. This is obviously based off of someone's true life story. And the film, this is the second biopic in a row that we've covered. We covered Sully last week, and this week we're covering Queen of Katwe. And mind you, yes, two totally different stories, but the unique way that, and we'll get into it in a little bit of the storytelling, I was really impressed overall with this film. I really did like it, and I really did think Disney kind of hit another grand slam three times in a row as far as their live action portion for this year.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the beautiful thing about kind of behind the scenes of the film is predominantly it was filmed in Uganda, which is where the story takes place. Mm-hmm. They used primarily African actors, not all of them Ugandan necessarily,
but most
of the performers are, you know, African nationals from, you know, one of
many
dozens of countries that are there. You know, the look, the feel, the colors, the sounds, everything is extremely authentic.
Oh yeah.
Feeling as an audience member, having never been to Uganda, but you know, it just has this feel of authenticity that a lot of times, even if you do have a great story like this, most of it's produced on some studio backlot somewhere, and you can kind of feel the manufacturedness of it all. And this one felt very, very present in its own setting.
Yeah,
if that's a way of describing
it. No, and that's totally legitimate, because there were scenes in the film where obviously it probably could have been cheaper to use a soundstage, and they did the scene on a soundstage, and they utilized, you know, like you said, the backlot of wherever, which just happens to be near some water, and they utilize that to be the nearby river of Katwe, and they're like, okay, we're going to use this to pinpoint this landmark over here so it looks like it, so people see it. Like, but no, it seems like there was a very organic feeling that you had when you saw the film. It was very organic is probably the best way to put it, because it seemed like you could actually visit the location and you could actually be there. And so the film overall was an exceptional film. One of the things that we did note, and we did mention earlier, the lead role was by a newcomer named Madina Nalwanga. Now, looking her up, she actually has no previous works.
Right.
Like, ever. Like, I'm pretty sure she probably did some, you know, in her school of acting or wherever she came from, things of that sort. She probably has some things there, but as far as previous roles.
Well,
and
I mean, the character that she's playing, the movie kind of gives an overview of several years of her life. But when she starts, I believe she's like 13 or 14 years old in the film. So this girl is not, you know, she's not like in her 30s.
No.
So
now she plays, I think, wasn't it 11 or 13 year old girl? One of those years, because it is from the years of 2009 to 2014 that the film covers, the time basis. So you do have that. But she really, Madina really is, she's very committed to that role. She seemed very comfortable in that role. It seemed like it was something that she was very familiar with. Sometimes whenever you see first timers on the screen, and you see them in unique roles, especially leading roles, you do sense that little bit of hesitancy that, you know, sometimes it doesn't always work out in certain scenes. And it seemed like every scene that I saw her in, which was the majority of the film, she was so phenomenal. She did really well.
Definitely. And the thing that they do really nicely in this film is they communicate with more than dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
So the film is set, Katwe is a more impoverished area, mm-hmm. Within Uganda. And so there are other Ugandans in some of the cities that look down on people from this particular area. Mm-hmm. And so they've kind of got a stigma against them. And part of what comes along with that is they've got, you know, roads that are washed out during the rainy season. Mm-hmm. They live in home spaces that are kind of scrapped together from corrugated aluminum and mm-hmm. cardboard and whatnot.
Pieces of fabric and, here and there for wheels.
So, you know, it's a definitely a hard scrabble kind of lifestyle that these people are living. And they allow the performers to really embody that mm-hmm. rather than just talk about it and yeah. gloss over it and move on or manufacture, you know, too much drama between the characters
mm-hmm.
That helps you through dialogue to understand a person's mindset. With this particular girl and many of her friends and her mother and some of the other characters, you actually just you read it in their body language. You read it in their demeanor. And they don't have to say it with words.
Yeah. And the believability of these characters on screen, it just seems so, they seem so familiar. It's almost like it goes beyond just simple camaraderie that you have on the set and everything. It seemed like the family vibe was true on and off the screen. The mother of Medina Nalwanga's character, played by Lupita Nyong'o, whom everyone knows from her previous roles in 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. as well as her role in Star Wars, The Force Awakens.
Well, I mean, motion capture, but
yeah. Motion capture, but her...
But yeah,
her,
12 Years a Slave, I mean, she got an Oscar for a reason.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the reason why I mentioned Star Wars is because she does play that motherly character as well there. And so to see that translated in a fully fleshed out role, not like some short alien to me on live screen or anything, no. But I mean, the motherly things that we saw her voice portray in Star Wars, and to see her really flesh out that motherly role in this film, I would have no doubt, and I'm not too sure, I don't know her age, I don't know a lot of her background, but I would most definitely probably bet, you know, my life savings that she has a very motherly heart off screen, because it translates just so well and it's so believable with her character in the film.
Yeah, well, and again, much of her performance, which in many cases is stunning, mm-hmm. much of her performance is nonverbal.
Yes.
It's really quite special to see in some of the scenes. I mean, you're sitting there basically reciting lines of dialogue in your head to explain to yourself what her face or her posture are communicating, because it's so clear
mm-hmm.
as a performer what she is telling you, what yeah. her character is going through.
And there is so much that this particular character is facing just in this film. Lupita Nyong'o plays a single mother, of all things, or whose husband passed away previously.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really get into that.
Husband and son, I believe. There was another... Older child. There was another child in the family. I think two. They both passed.
Well, so she carries a lot of that burden of being the head of the household, you know, providing and things of that nature.
So she still has two daughters and two sons.
Yes.
In the home to provide for in a very impoverished area.
Yes, and you see Lupita really carry that weight so well on her face, and like you said, a lot of the nonverbal scenes were some of the most powerful, because the simple turn of a head from a statement that was made, or the mere closing of a curtain so mm-hmm. that her son doesn't see her cry, to continue the portrayal of strength. A lot of those scenes just really spoke to me, and they really just reached out and created that sense of just, you know, intimacy with myself and emergence within myself and the film. It really grabs you.
Yeah, I thought that in retrospect, in terms of the performers within the film, I thought that she, Lupita, had the most challenging
mm-hmm.
role, because she displays a wide range of emotions and thoughts and motivations and whatever over the course of the film. without ever losing her center. Like, the center is still true. It's not the kind of character who, you know, swings widely to the left and then swings widely back the other way to the right. She does go through a whole series of extreme emotions, and the circumstances are just devastating sometimes, what happens in their lives. And yet the center of her performance is rock solid. And it's almost all done non-verbally.
Yeah.
I mean, there's she does have lines, and she does speak with her children and some other people, but it's very sparing. The dialogue to screen time ratio with that character in particular is pretty minimal.
Yeah. And that also brings us to the next character of the film who has a very major role, David Oyelowo's character, Michael Katende, who happens to be the chess instructor, so to speak, because he doesn't start out as a chess instructor. He starts out as a aspiring engineer who wants to have a great job and unfortunately can't
get hired. And in the meantime, he works for a ministry and helps kids.
Yeah. And he plays that role. And I think he is kind of the anchor for me. He was kind of the anchor throughout the entire film as far as role wise. Not to say that because he's a male or whatever, but I think because his driving force of continuously encouraging the children to aspire for not just success on the checkerboard or the checkered board, but to also apply it as well to life and so forth. And you know, even to giving advice to Lupita Nyong'o's character, I think he really does carry that mantle well. I really do like this actor. I think he's phenomenal in a lot of the roles that he does. And this one just really allows him to blossom a little bit more as not just an individual for this or that, but to really kind of give his heart and lay it there on the line.
Well,
for
and here's the thing with the subtext of this movie, and they never ever mention this. I happen to know this because I've had quite a few friends who've traveled to Uganda and spent time there for years at a time. But Uganda, because for generations there's been struggle and strife. There was warfare, you know, 20 years ago, whatever. Mm-hmm. So right now, as of 2015, nearly 50% of the population in the country of Uganda is below the age of 15. So just like the adult to child ratio in that country is not what you would necessarily consider to be typical. So what I love about this film is it actually starts from his character's point of view. You don't start with Fiona, the young girl who's wanting to become a grandmaster at chess. You start with Katende's character and his job search troubles and whatnot, and then you meet her roughly 5 minutes into the film, I'd say. So in a way, he is the point of view character. He's definitely the most... He has the most lines of dialogue by far because he interacts with all the kids. He interacts with the mother. He interacts with the officials of the chess Olympiad and other tournaments. He interacts with other Ugandan officials who are trying to form a chess team of their best players. I mean, so he has a lot of... interacts with his wife, who's a school teacher. He has most of the speaking responsibilities as far as the script on paper is concerned. I thought it was really interesting because... Much of the film is his character and the children.
Yeah.
Either one at a time or as a group. And I think that especially when you're talking about a place like Uganda where the need for that mentoring is so great because he's not that much older than they are.
No.
His firstborn is like a baby and he's mentoring, you know, these 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15-year-olds, right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And playing soccer to support them financially as much as he can. He's working to feed them when they come to learn and play chess. All this stuff is going on. I thought that was a really cool angle. It's not even an angle, let's be honest. This is a true life story.
Exactly,
this is based
yeah.
on real events.
This is the way reality of life.
That actual Mr. Katende lived and lives his life.
Yeah. I just a quick note and we'll move forward, but I just in all transparency, there's a line that he says in the film that just really tugs at you, and it's a powerful scene. It's quick and it's blink and you'll miss it kind of deal, but you know, there's a scene where Medina Fiona's in the middle of a chess match and she's kind of wavering, and he just stands up and he says, "You belong here." And it's a powerful scene, and the way he presents it and the way he delivers the line, and just his face. Oh my gosh, his face, the look of determination for her to understand this, and the way it's translated to her, and the when she gets it, that's one of my favorite scenes. But one of the unique things about this film is, like we said, it is a biopic, so it is a film that is told of another story, so to speak. It's the telling of a true story. So this story obviously is a real life situation, and it's told like you said in the perspective of Michael. But I thought the way they formulated this story and they allowed it to be presented all the way to the resolution of it, I thought was incredible. I really did. I liked the way they presented the end of the movie as the beginning, and followed suit by doing the whole, so this is what's happening right now, and before we get into this, let's backtrack a few years.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, and mind you, it's probably an overdone trope. It's probably, you know, been done countless times in cinema. But I thought the usage of this in this particular story, with the weight of what this story holds, was a very smart choice.
Well, you don't know when the movie starts that the quick little teaser bit that they show you is something that you're not going to see the whole scene of right then. Mm-hmm. Like, they cut the scene and then they go back. You don't know what year that scene is set in. You don't know what year the new scene is set in. Like, you kind of get your bearings as you go, which is, it's fine. It works. One thing I did want to also say is, while we are saying that much of the film is from the point of view of Katende,
mm-hmm.
I do want to mention that in no way does that diminish the importance of this young girl as the focal point of the film, because really having him as the point of view character does not necessarily make him the main character.
Yeah.
And in this film, I think having him as the point of view character, that's kind of like where the audience is supposed to see the story from.
Yes.
So as he observes this young lady developing her intellect, her passion, her perseverance to learn and learn and learn chess. She doesn't know how to read
mm-hmm.
in the beginning. It takes a long time for her to learn how to read, but she's extremely intelligent, and she kind of has this aggressive way of playing chess because of her background, because of not having grown up playing chess, you know, before she started learning. So you get to see all that specialness in her
mm-hmm.
because his character is the point of view character.
Yeah.
So I do want to say, in no way does it diminish that she is the main character. The mm-hmm. the movie is named after her. The book is named after her. Like, it's a reference to her.
Yeah.
Not to him, but you see her through his eyes as yeah. her mentor, her teacher, sort of a surrogate father in many ways,
mm-hmm.
not only to her, but to the other kids. And there is a special luster that point of view has.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes the overall experience of the film very special.
That's very true. And to really point out kind of what you're saying, having a particular point of view in a film does not specifically state that film's main focus should be on the point of view character. Mm-hmm. It's merely a perspective. It's merely the way like you said, the director, the filmmakers are wanting the audience to see the main character through whose eyes, through whom's eyes, mm-hmm. through whose eyes, whomever's eyes, somebody's eyeballs.
Sure.
You're looking through these people's through eyeballs to take note of the particular perspective of the main character from a specific viewpoint. And I think that's really important to note, because like Chad said, you know, Medina did an exceptional job. Lupita Nyong'o did an absolute exceptional job, as always. So his perspective, his point of view, does not necessarily dictate that he is the main character. He is as much as a contributing character as much as the rest of them. We're just highlighting the fact that it's his point of view.
Yeah, and in a way, he works as a cipher for the audience, too, mm-hmm. because you, like him, you want success
yeah.
for her and for her family. You want a happy ending. You want triumph and victory in spite of the obstacles. I mean, you want all those things. The cool thing, we said before, ESPN, the man who wrote the book is an ESPN guy, and this movie was produced I mean, ESPN is at some level owned by Disney, but Disney and ESPN co-produced this film.
There's connection somewhere.
Because it really is, it's your classic sports film, yeah, right? Of the underdog triumphing, but it happens to not be an activity sport. It's chess as a sport, but the strategy, the stick-to-itness, like all of that that you love about a good sports movie is completely present in this film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And as we said about the film, the film is a biopic, so it is based on true events. And like I said, the storytelling of it is really well done. Disney, as I said earlier, has had some great success this year with live-action films from the BFG, half animation, half live-action.
Well, from a storytelling point of view, you saw it and you loved it.
Yeah.
It did not perform well in the box office.
True that. But that could be also...
From a creative perspective, it was successful. From a financial perspective, not so much.
And then you also had Pete's Dragon, which was another live action.
Kind of same boat, yeah.
And mind you, let's just be real. Unfortunately, numbers are what mostly matters in studios and all that. But the stories that they gave were really great stories. And so for me, those two were successes. And then this one is kind of the grand slam of all three. This is the one that has all the right components, all the right things, all the right parts, all the right stuff.
And no CGI.
And it just hits it out of the park. It is just a great film. I mean, from the introduction of characters, the actresses and actors that are in it, all the way to the music. The music, which was subtle yet still appropriate for each scene, it really helps push the scenes along. For me, it was an exceptional score.
Oh, I agree. And I think that really one of the truly special things, and I think this may have been in play to a certain degree with the movie we reviewed last week as well, Sully, the fact that the people that the story is based on are still alive,
mm-hmm,
I think does actually inform the performances, especially in this film. I think that if you're a performer and you're saying, okay, here's the script, it's a solid script, the story is inspiring, and I want to do right by the character on the page, right? That's one level of buy-in, mm-hmm, for a role. Then you meet the person that you are portraying on screen, and you want to do right by them. You want to respect who they are, what's happened in their life,
material,
where it's all come from. And I truly feel in this case, in this film, that is there in spades. You know, you've got David
Oyelowo
had the opportunity, undoubtedly, to sit down with Michael Katende, listen to his story from his perspective, gain respect for the man because he's, mm-hmm, extremely respectable,
mm-hmm,
and then wanted to do like beyond his best.
Oh yeah,
showing what an exceptional human being this guy is.
Oh yeah,
Lupita Nyong'o with the real Fiona's mother. Forgive me, I don't remember her name, but having met her, heard her story, learned what this woman went through with her situation for her children, the struggles that she had with her oldest daughter, who's kind of in and out of the picture throughout the course of the film. You know, you look that human being in the eye, and then you have to go and embody their story on the screen. I think that does something to a performer, and I think it really brought out some amazing things for everybody in this film.
Yeah, and it's true as far as the recency of this film correlating to how long ago the actual incident happens, the actual story happens. I mean, you're looking at maybe a separation of what, 2 years, 2-3 years since the incident,
the end of the movie is, you know, a couple, 3 years ago. Yeah.
And the
like
great
that.
Thing about this is it kind of just nails what Chad just said home with the ending of the film, where after the entire film takes place, it blacks out, transitions to black, and then it fades back in, and you see the actress and the person appear who they're portraying. So you actually have Medina Nalwanga, and you have Fiona actually appear on screen together.
Side by side.
And I thought
and they
that
do
was,
it with all of them.
They do, including all the side characters, all the people that you're like, oh, okay, that was...
Extremely unique and very special. You should definitely stick around for the beginning of the credit sequence on this one.
Yeah, and it just, it nails just that mindset all the way home for anybody who thinks, well...
Well, and it continues the story.
Yes.
I mean, you get to hear what happened to these people after the events of the movie ended.
Mm-hmm. Any other things that you saw that rung out to you, that really spoke to you? Excuse me, got the hiccups now. I'm like, any other...
You know, I think what it boils down to for me is this film is extremely authentic and genuine, and you really do feel it. And I think that the icing on the cake is just like you were mentioning. In that end credit sequence, you have the actor and the real-life person that they were portraying in the film. It is... beyond special and cool to see this is the actual person, especially when you get to somebody like one of the little kids in the group.
Yeah.
Or her younger brother, Fiona's youngest brother, like the
who's like a
toddler in the movie.
Yeah.
Is like a baby and then a toddler. So there are two different actors that play the part. But then, like, the boy himself has grown up and is high school age now, and he's ridiculously tall.
Yeah.
You know, and it's amazing. It's a really cool experience by the end.
So, Chad, does it pass or does it fail for you, and how many monocles?
I think it definitely passes. I would say for this one, I mean, it had everything that I wanted it to have. It was inspirational. It was surprising. It showed me... something I had never seen before, you know, culturally and in terms of the chess aspect. I've never followed chess. I've never read books on chess. I've played the game a few times, but not enough to be even all that good.
Yeah.
So I would give it 5 out of 5.
You'd give it a 5.
I would give it 5 out of 5.
Wow, that's powerful. Of course,
I really like authentic stories.
That's true. You are a glutton for, you know, nonfiction, and so of course this is going to be one of your larger ones. For me, it obviously passes. Yes, I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed the flow of this story. I really enjoyed the actors and actresses that played in the film. They were just exceptionally done. Great portrayals of the characters, and I would probably have to give it a 4.5 out of 5. It's really up there. It's really well done, like I said, and I had a great time with it. But that does transition to our special segment today. We are actually doing a brand new one, and let me ask you if you can probably hear what this segment is called. Let's take a listen.
Yes, 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 oh, yes, 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 oh, 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 God, oh.
I'll have what she's having.
Yes, the segment is called Yes. No, the segment is called I'll Have What She's Having.
Completely irreverent, but not irrelevant.
It's not irrelevant. In this segment, we're actually going to start highlighting the wonderful women who are under-celebrated behind the scenes in cinema. In tonight's episode, we're actually going to celebrate the director of this particular film. Her name is Meera Nair. Born in Bhubaneswar, Orissa, in India. She was educated at the Delhi University and at Harvard, so she has both doctorates at both places. She's exceptionally intelligent. She began acting all the way back in, I believe, 1971. Her career goes as far as that, but her directing debut started in 1988 with a film she made called Salaam Bombay. It was a great film. I haven't technically seen it, but I did read a lot of the reviews for it, and it actually won an Oscar that year for the best foreign film. So,
yeah, I haven't seen it either, but I mean, your first film as a director wins an Oscar.
Yeah,
that's pretty darn good.
So later on, she would go on to direct films with notable names such as Denzel Washington, Marissa Tomei, Angelica Huston, and Chaz Palminteri. What?
Houston. Angelica Houston.
Thought it was Huston.
Yeah. It's okay.
That's a weird name. I like it. Some of her more notable works are 2003's Monsoon Wedding, 2006 The Namesake. You were actually mentioning that one a little bit ago, The Namesake.
Yeah, based on a book and, you know, visionary. You know, it's the beautiful thing about this particular director. You can tell even the movie that we saw, Queen of Katwe, you can see, again, just the rich, authentic portrayal of life.
Yeah.
Is obviously something that she takes seriously. And I do want to say, we did a whole show a few weeks ago about women behind the scenes in Hollywood.
Yes.
And getting more women behind the camera, behind the keyboard, writing the script, behind the mixer, doing the audio and all of that, composing and cinematography and whatever, editing, all of it. And we highlighted how long it took for a female directed film to win for it to get Best Picture and for her to be, receive accolades. This woman, Mira Nair, it might be pronounced, her directorial debut film,
right out the gate,
went into competition as India's entry for the Best Foreign Picture Oscar. Every nation on the planet can submit one film for nomination consideration to that category, and then ultimately I think five or six are chosen for the whole Academy to vote on. But every single country in the world aside from America can submit one film to that category. Fast forward the story and she got the Oscar.
Yeah,
her directorial debut.
Right out of the
gate. That's amazing.
It is. And as you see with Queen of Katwe, and as well as a lot of her other works, like Chad said, it's a very, very intimate type of feel for a lot of her films. She's very big on the family dynamic and creating roles within that family as far as who is the mother, who is the father. Monsoon Wedding is a great portrayal of that because of the fact of the father going nuts because of the wedding and all that. It's a great film. And this is a great director, and I'm excited to say that we here at the Film Philmosophers are celebrating Mira Nair, if we're butchering your name, sorry, but we love you.
Yeah, 1,000 apologies if we're completely wrong.
But you know what?
Doesn't change the way we feel about your work.
Exactly. We love you, and we are celebrating who you are in cinema. Before we go, we're going to leave you with a few movie bites. The new trailer for Tupac Shakur's biopic, All Eyes on Me, gives a unique glimpse into the hip-hop icon's life. Sausage Party co-director Conrad Vernon is set to helm the Toxic Avenger remake. And Captain America Civil War gets an honest trailer.
And is also out on DVD, so go buy it a lot.
But, yeah, we're huge fans of honest trailers and as you probably may know or may not know, the Epic Movie Voice, who does the honest
our own
trailers,
intro, yeah,
he does a lot of the stuff for Screen Junkies honest trailers. He is the gentleman who so graciously lended his talents to allow us to have the intro that we have. So a thousand thanks to him. And you know what? The honest trailer for that film is funny
and very lengthy. I mean, it goes.
Oh yeah, it does.
Most honest trailers are 3 minutes. This one's 6. Something like that.
They
gave a lot of time to that honest trailer.
Well, that about wraps up another great show for us. Of course, if you have any thoughts about this review, or maybe you agree with us and you just want to let us know other little tidbits, let us know on Facebook at facebook.com/philosophers, or drop us a line on Twitter at twitter.com/philosophy101. We've had a great time with you, and of course, if you have any other thoughts, any other things, anything else, you can check us out as well on VGB Studios, where you can hear all our previous episodes. You can check out VGB, and you can check out me, myself, and I. Exceptional film. We had a great time today, Chad.
Yep, it comes out September 30th, so mark it on your calendar. It's not here yet. You have time to prepare and get your ticket in advance.
That's right. But we had an awesome time today. I'm still kind of excited. I'm still shaking with energy, but I'm good. So, yeah, let's just close this up, shall we?
That's it. Yeah, we're excited. We're happy. Authentic, good. Go see Queen of Katwe.
Yes. Well, from all of us here at the Film Philosophers, my name's Eddie.
I'm Chad.
Class dismissed.